leave as soon as he could. So anyway, thank you for being here. You all received a, let's go around the room and have people introduce themselves, should we? Let's, Laura, start with you.
Laura Vernon, Forestry Fern State Lands.
Jake Vanderlaan, Division of Water Quality.
Don Leonard with the Bryan Shrimp Cooperative.
Randy Elliott, Davis County Commissioner.
Jeff Scott, Moxley County Commission.
Chris Montague, sitting for Dave Livermore.
Joe Havasey, Compass Mineral, sitting for Todd Bingham.
Tom Moore, representing municipalities.
And the bill with the nature conservancy.
Max Longquist, National Audubon Society.
Georgie Mercury, Great Sully Cottonwood.
Jeff from Laker, Jacobson Jane.
Ryan Cottom, the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands.
Candace Hoffmaker, the Division of Water Resources.
Jeff Ray with Utah Water Power Association.
Jan Strickel, Utah Moving Rivers. Nika Roundy, Davis County, and Great Salt Lake Bird Festival. We have programs here, and we still have trips open for you to sign up.
Ashley Kajowski, Division of Wildlife, sitting in for John Luft.
Ken Kramer, Division of Wildlife Resources, at our Ogden office.
Andrew Bonkel, Maine, County Commissioner.
Craig Miller, Utah Division of Water Resources.
Chris Miller, Division of Water Resources. Thank you, everyone, for being here. You all received an agenda in advance. I'd entertain a motion to approve that agenda.
So moved.
Thank you, Jeff. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Randy. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? Unanimous. You also received a copy of meeting notes of our January 9, 2019 meeting. We received no corrections or revisions to those, so I'll entertain a motion to approve them.
So moved.
Thank you, Jeff. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Tom. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? That's unanimous. Let's move to committee reports. Again, Leland's at a water quality meeting and hoping to get here, but I'll briefly give, I think, the report he would have given. As you know, we have a vacancy for Weber County. That's being worked through the system. Leland has spoken with him and hope to have that one resolved soon. Salt Lake County, Carlton Christensen hasn't resigned. They're in the process of getting successor for him. He's informed us that Wilf Summercorn would try to attend on his behalf, but obviously Wilf couldn't make it today. That is in process. So we hope to have those two resolved by our next meeting. The next report has to do with the council's annual report, and since the Nature Conservancy provides so much of the great effort on that, I've asked Chris if he wouldn't mind sharing that with us.
Sure. We're happy to help out in this way, and we think this is a great tool, especially to talk about some of the big, summarize and talk about some of the big scale topics that are going onward. So we distribute this to our staff and board and take them to meetings often. But we were not the ones that contacted and met with the legislature, so Don, maybe you could.
Sure. As you know, it's been our practice to provide this to each and every member of the legislature. We have it delivered to their desks in both the House and Senate, the cover note. We've also used it on the Hill in meetings discussing issues. It's a good opener, and people are familiar with it. And Nature Conservancy does such a great job with the graphics and the layout. It represents us well, I think. We also have distributed to some people in the Department of Natural Resources, but it's my intention, as soon as the session's over and I get a breath of fresh air, Laura and I are going to go door to door and deliver it to officials at the Department of Natural Resources, just to make sure it gets to where and who it needs to get to. That's a distribution plan. We do have a few extras. If you need some, please let Laura know and she'll supply them to you if you want to use them in any way to help promote the efforts of the Great Salt Lake. So thank you very much, Chris, and thanks to Nature Conservancy for their good work. Next topic is just a brief update on the council project on assessing potential costs of declining water levels of Great Salt Lake. As you you know, EFO Northwest was selected to do that project, and it's underway. We've had a couple of meetings with them, and they're doing their spade work. We expect to see the final copy by the, they're on track to complete it by July 1, which is their deadline. And we would anticipate that at our July meeting on July 10th, they'll be here to present it to the group and give us their report and their results. So if you have any questions about that, feel free to contact Laura or myself. Any questions from the group now? Okay. As you know, we launched two report projects last year. We had the one report I just mentioned on the assessment of potential costs of defining water levels of Great Salt Lake. And that's basically, the purpose was to provide a comprehensive accounting of what the potential loss of a healthy Great Salt Lake and wetlands due to declining water levels would mean to the economy and quality of life. And to assess what amounts to avoided costs if the lake receives seasonally adequate levels. The project we're here to talk about today and to receive is a report on the consequences of drying lake systems around the world. Our objective in launching this study was to prepare a survey of drying lakes around the world that would illustrate the economic, social, and environmental consequences of the loss or significant impairment of permanent lake systems due to declining water levels. This report wasn't intended to trigger new research, but it was basically a literature review of the information that's out there and a compilation of that. And we selected AECOM to do that work. They met all their deadlines, and you all received by email a copy of their final report. We've asked Andrew Baumholt, the project manager, to be here today to walk us through a summary of the report. We very much appreciate working with her and her team and the results of the project. So Andrew, let me turn the time over to you and let you walk us through it.
Thanks, Tom. So I'm Andrea Baumholt, senior economist with AECOM, and our team put together this report because there are a lot of significant saline rate lakes around the world that are drying at alarming rates. And although these saline lakes may grow and shrink with natural climatic variation, human impacts and specifically diversions have been causing desiccation that may not be able to reverse without some intervention. So to better understand the implications of the drying of the Great Salt Lake, we reviewed the economic, social, and environmental consequences of drying lakes around the world. So saline lakes provide a diverse range of ecological, sociological, and economic benefits. For the economic side, they support mining, aquaculture, and tourism industries. Socially, they provide recreational opportunities. When they're not dry, it's a dust mitigation in a sense, and they provide climate moderating benefits. In some cases, saline lakes can buffer temperature and humidity changes for nearby agricultural fields, which can allow farmers to harvest earlier. And the Great Salt Lake can benefit the nearby ski resorts with that the lake effect snow that we, most of us, have been able to enjoy at some point up at the resorts. Environmentally, many saline lakes around the world have been designated as Ramsar wetlands of international importance or as Western Hemispheric shorebird reserve sites. Wetlands provide aquatic habitat, open water, emergent marsh, mudflats, and playa. And that's critical habitat for migratory shorebirds, and waterfowl that use saline lakes for nesting and feeding grounds. And they're supported by a dense invertebrate population as a food source. So while there are more than 25 significant lakes drying around the world, this study focused on 8 terminal saline lakes that share characteristics with the Great Salt Lake. So this report is based on an extensive literature review and provides a descriptive inventory of each of these drying lake systems with a focus on the associated economic, social, and environmental consequences. So I'm going to go through and give an overview of each one of these case studies that we reviewed. Lake Urmia is the largest lake in Iran and the second largest hypersaline lake in the world. It was listed as a Ramsar site and UNESCO Biosphere Reserve. Development pressures, particularly irrigation for agriculture, have led to the rapid shrinking of the lake size. And between 1995 and 2013, Lake Urmia shrank from 2,400 square miles to 400 square miles. Lake Urmia is known for its natural attractions, such as beautiful beaches, cypress trees, wild pistachio, and mountainous almonds. It's estimated that it would be $1.4 billion for a restoration program. And currently, they have a project in place that's costs about $56 million to transfer water from the Kananisib River. As the lake dries, it leaves behind a fine-grained salt, resulting in saline dust storms. And these dust storms deposit salt on the agricultural land, which increases soil salinization and reduces soil productivity. So this reduces agricultural efficiency, which affects profitability and threatens the livelihood of the farmers in the region. And if these dust storms render the nearby agricultural lands unusable, rural farmers in the area would be displaced. Sorry, I'm trying to find my cursor. So when they're displaced, they are forced to migrate to search for work. And that saline dust is a fine-grade particulate matter with a diameter fewer than 10 micrometers. We refer to that as PM10. PM10 is dangerous because it can settle deep into a person's lungs, and that's a potential hazard to people, especially those with lung disease and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, but it can cause a wide range of health effects. The desiccation of the lake has increased the size of the salt deserts around the lake significantly. 86% of the lake became a salt desert between 1998 and 2014. And the increased salinity has decreased the density of brine shrimp and threatened their survival in the ecosystem. And that affects the migratory birds that feed on those brine shrimps. And the number of migratory birds have been reduced by thousands. And thousands have died in recent years from starvations. And that migratory bird population includes large flamingo populations. The next case study is the Aral Sea. This is a terminal lake located in Central Asia. It's south of Kazakhstan and to the north of Uzbekistan. The Soviet Union began a large-scale water diversion project in the 1960s. And the South Aral Sea is almost completely desiccated. And a small portion of the North Aral Sea has been revived but not completely restored. So the only realistic approach to substantially increasing flow to the Aral Sea is reducing consumptive use of water for irrigation in the drainage basin. And some improvement measures are being implemented. However, a comprehensive program to renovate the antiquated irrigation and drainage systems on 13.3 million acres is estimated to cost between $24 and $33.6 billion. And even that would not completely restore the Aral Sea.
That's just an estimate that hasn't been committed, right?
Right, that's how much it's estimated, but that doesn't mean they're actually moving forward with that. That's just how much they're estimating it would cost. Right now they have spent more than $270.7 million for restoration projects. Prior to desiccation impacts, the Aral Sea supported a substantial fishing industry. However, the industries ended in the 1980s because increasing salinity levels and the loss of spawning and feeding areas led to extinction of indigenous fish from the sea. And as a result, 60,000 fishermen lost their livelihood. And then we have the effects of that dry lake bed causing public health impacts from the PM10 from the dust storms. Because these are terminal lakes, the agricultural runoff goes down into that lake bed, and so all of those toxins are in the lake bed, and that when there's that dust storm, those can travel up to 300 miles. So there's been high levels of esophageal cancer, respiratory illnesses, and eye problems in the surrounding region. Desertification in the region has been expanding and intensifying due to reduced river flows and declining groundwater levels caused by the lowering levels of the Aral Sea. The mammal and bird species have been reduced by half. There's threatened the bird population is threatened, and the native plants have been reduced by plants that are more adapted to dry and saline conditions. The next case study is Lake Popo. I may be saying it right or wrong, but I don't know. Lake Popo is located in the Altiplano Mountains in Bolivia. It's exhibited desiccation impacts for decades as a result of the cyclical El Nino droughts and water diversions, and it has dried several times in the past. Prior to desiccation impacts, Lake Popo had an active fishing industry. After the loss of the fishing industry, the loss of income to the region resulted in migration of up to thousands of residents from the region. On November 18, 2014, millions of dead fish and hundreds of dead birds washed up on the lakeshore, leaving behind a 19-mile-long, 10-foot-wide band. The mass die-off was a result of high winds that drove fish to low oxygen waters where they suffocated, and the event demonstrates the fragility of that ecosystem. Next lake is Owens Lake. This is located in Inyo County, California. This is the lake bed is 200 miles north of LA. The Los Angeles Aqueduct was constructed in 1913 to divert water from the Owens River. And by 1925, the diversion caused Owens Lake levels to recede so rapidly that all that remains now is a dry lake bed and some mud flats. And the bed of Owens Lake is one of the highest sources of dust pollution in the United States. In order to operate the aqueduct, the City of Los Angeles is required to provide a state implementation plan, or SIP, to demonstrate how it will attain the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for PM10 as required by the Clean Air Act. So the LADWP has been operating the Owens Lake Dust Mitigation Program since 2001, and mitigation costs are expected to increase to $3.6 billion through 2025. Dust mitigation accounts for approximately 15% or nearly 2 months out of every LA ratepayer's annual water bill. So there's, from those dust storms, they have public health impacts to approximately 40,000 permanent residents. And as I mentioned before, the EPA declared it the worst source of PM10 in the US. Recently, Owens Lake qualified as a Western Hemisphere Shorebird Reserve Network site of an international importance, and it now supports more than 100,000 shorebirds annually. And so that's as a consequence of rehydration efforts. The next sea is the Salton Sea. This is a high saline terminal lake located in the southeastern region of California, about 35 miles north of the US-Mexico border. The Salton Sea is a wetland system of ecological importance, providing refuge for over 380 avian species. In 2003, the Imperial Irrigation District agreed to the Quantification Settlement Agreement, in which the Irrigation District agreed to transfer increasing volumes of water to San Diego and Los Angeles. Based on that agreement, the Salton Sea was expected to drop 5 feet between 2006 and 2017. The Imperial Irrigation District agreed to provide additional water or mitigation water to the Salton Sea through 2017 to address the sea's desiccation. But the loss of that mitigation water since 2017 has accelerated changes in water levels and salinity. And the state of California anticipates an additional 77 square miles of dry lake bed will become exposed between 2018 and 2028. The Salton Sea Management Plan, or SSMP, was developed to protect air quality and the ecosystem values of the Salton Sea. Phase one of the project is expected to build about 30,000 acres of habitat and reduce total exposed acres from about 48,000 acres to about 18,500 acres by 2028. And the cost for that project is $427 million. Prior to desiccation impacts, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife stocked the Salton Sea with a variety of sport fish, and the Salton Sea supported a strong sport fishing industry. And in the 60s, recreation activities around the lake contributed about $550 million, but that has been reduced to about $26.5 million over time. So they've had a loss of recreation, a complete loss of the, or a loss to the commercial and sport fishing industry. And dust and noxious odors could also depress property values beyond the nearest few miles and impact businesses. So the total impact to property values has been estimated to be up to $7 billion. Because of the dust storms, child asthma hospitalization rates are the highest in California in this area, and three times the California average. Emergency room visits for children's are over twice the statewide average for California. And the public health impacts from these dust storms is estimated to be $40 billion. So the Salton Sea ecological benefits have been estimated to be $2.8 billion, but that's declining as the sea shrinks and continues to dry. The fish populations have declined by over 95%. And this is one of the few remaining wetland habitats for avian species in California. The next is the Dead Sea, which is located on the border of Jordan and Israel in the Jordan Rift Valley. At 1,400 feet below sea level, the Dead Sea is the lowest spot on Earth. And the Dead Sea consists of two basins. So there's a deeper northern basin and a southern basin. The southern basin is currently dried up and is used only for mineral production, commercial mineral production. The northern basin is sourced by winter rain floods and the Jordan River, and it's dense with salt minerals and has a saline concentration of about 34%. The Dead Sea has been shrinking since the early 20th century, dropping more than 66 feet in that time period. The drying of the Dead Sea has accelerated most recently, dropping an average rate of 3 feet per year over the past decade. At the end of 2013, a memorandum of understanding was signed between Jordan, the Palestinian Authority, and Israel to begin the first phase of the Red Sea desalination project at Aqaba, or RSDS. The purpose of the RSDS is to build a desalination facility in Jordan to transform the Red Sea water into potable water while pumping the remaining brine water back into the Dead Sea. The total construction cost is estimated to be $11 billion with an annual O&M cost of $440 million. So without this reclamation, the potential loss would be $265 million to the region. And the Dead Sea is providing $800 million in annual revenue for minerals extraction. And one of the problems is that the rate of sinkhole formation is increasing as the water levels continue to recede and exposed bottomlands increase. So they've had injuries as well as property damage from over 1,000 sinkholes that have happened. And this is threatening the tourism industry, which is the main livelihood of the region. The Dead Sea supports unique natural habitat of substantial biodiversity, which includes 450 species of plants and 150 species of animals. And those, the steep slopes and the earthquake-associated landslides are another environmental hazard. Baktigin Lake is located in Fars Province, Iran. Baktigin Lake was the second largest lake in Iran behind Lake Urmia, which is the first lake we discussed. The water levels of Lake Baktigin fluctuate according to the level of precipitation. During dry years, the lake dries out completely. The lake ecosystem hosts 46 species of mammals, 218 avian species, 36 reptile species, and 23 species of fish. Irrigated agriculture is the dominant and highest yielding economic activity in the Lake Kaskaskia Basin. Increased water scarcity threatens the agricultural sector, which plays a critical role in Iran's economy and consumes 90% of the water in Iran. So you can see as they have issues with water scarcity, it could also stimulate some social conflicts. Water scarcity results from the natural hazard of a severe drought in 1999 to 2000 imposed a direct cost of $2.4 billion to the agricultural sector. So that's not directly related to the lake drying, but just to kind of demonstrate how reliant they are on the water. Bactigan Lake hosts a substantial tourism industry based on the aesthetic value of the dynamic landscape, biodiversity, and its natural beauty. The livelihood of the surrounding population is threatened not only by the decline in agriculture, but the decline in tourism-based employment opportunities in recent years. And this was declared a protected zone in 1968. And in 1975, it was registered in Ramsar's Convention List of International Wetlands. The loss of wetland habitat from the drying of Bactigan Lake resulted in a major mortality of flamingo chicks in 2007. And in July 2017, about 1,000 flamingo chicks stuck in the salt marsh were rescued by locals and environmental officials. Mono Lake is located in East Central California. It's situated at the edge of the Great Basin in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Mono Lake began shrinking in 1941 when the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, or LADWP, began diverting four of the lake's tributary streams to address the water needs of Los Angeles. The water diversions resulted in a 45-foot drop in the surface elevation of the lake between 1941 and 1982. Resulting in a 30% reduction in surface area by the later date, and it went from 90 square miles to 60 square miles. A series of lawsuits led to the State Water Resources Control Boards issuing the Mono Lake Basin Water Right Decision in 1994. This decision prohibited water exports until the water level of Lake Mono reached 6,377 feet above sea level. And as a result of this decision, Mono Lake levels have been above the minimum level since 1995. So that had a major impact for this lake. In the 1920s and 30s, Mono Lake was a popular recreation spot, which supported the tourism industry within the Mono Basin. However, the drying of the lake limited almost all boating to canoes and kayaks. With the lake's recovery, tourism remains a significant industry in Mono County. Due to the saline dust that arises from the exposed lake bed, Mono County was designated as a non-attainment area for the state's PM10 standard in 1993. However, PM10 concentrations remained relatively stable since water levels have exceeded the minimum elevation threshold, thereby reducing the impacts of dust storms and associated consequences. So this is a case where you can see where they've made a decision to keep that water level, and it's helped reverse some of these impacts. Mono Lake is of particular environmental importance because it's the largest breeding ground for California gulls in California. The increased salinity concentrations affect the reproductive abilities of brine shrimp, which is a key species in the ecosystem. And the reduction in the lake volume also reduced wetland habitat for the flora and fauna. But since the lake levels have stabilized, it's resulted in stable saline concentrations and wetland habitat. So this is kind of a success story, you could say. So in conclusion, delaying the restoration and mitigation of the Great Salt Lake desiccation can have substantial economic, social, and environmental consequences for the Salt Lake Valley. For the economic consequences, there's a threat to property values. A lot of these lakes that we reviewed were in very rural areas. But the Great Salt Lake is next to a very urban area, as we all know. So you can see much higher consequences there. There's a threatened to complete loss to the mining, agricultural, tourism, and commercial fishing industries. And as a prior study estimated that Great Salt Lake contributes $1.3 billion to the local economy. There's a threat to the unique ecosystems and tremendous biodiversity of the Great Salt Lake. And a threat to the complete loss of brine shrimp and birds. And of course, PM10 from dry saline lake beds can increase asthma attacks, asthma severity, hospitalizations, lung disease, and symptoms and infections. And again, a lot of these lakes that we looked at were in more rural areas. So if you can imagine, if that dust can travel up to 300 miles, that can impact a pretty great population. Of course, with geography and different things, you know, it may not be exactly 300 miles, but it can impact a lot of people in this area, potentially. Mitigation and restoration measures can be costly and should be selected, designed and implemented strategically to maximize return on investment. So we can learn from some of these other areas what they have done, what's worked. Restoration costs tend to increase in accordance with the severity of lake desiccation. So you can see the longer you wait and the further the lake dries, it's going to be a lot more expensive to restore it. So we have an opportunity right now to preserve and protect the Great Salt Lake before those restoration costs become too high to manage. And although the mitigation and restoration costs are high, the economic, social, and environmental consequences are likely much higher. And that's all I have.
Hey, thank you. I've asked Laura if she'd prepare a pop quiz. Hand it out. There are four or five questions about each lake. I expect
that. Try to use my
Is it open book?
Yeah. Truthfully, I'm delighted with how much substantive information there is out there about the eight lakes that were chosen to survey. And you feel a little bit of an overload, really, with numbers. And they're billions, not millions of dollars. I was caught by the 60,000 fishing job losses that were presented. So any questions or comments for Andrea? We'll pass on
quick question. A pop quiz?
We'll pass on it.
Two. That's the answer. One quick question. I know that all the lakes that were looked at are lakes that are in significant stress and jeopardy. Were there any significant saline lakes that are not in stress or jeopardy?
So
that
we were
out there that you, when you did your assessment to begin to start to narrow it down?
We focused on terminal saline lakes that were drying. So we weren't really researching lakes that weren't drying.
Okay, but we didn't notice, I mean, in trying to find the drying ones, did you find ones that weren't drying? Mm-hmm. I guess maybe that's the question.
That's a good question. I will have to take that one back. So I didn't actually do the research on this one. Presenting it, so I will have to check back with.
I can tell you one in Saskatchewan right now that's a record level. That's the Big Quill Lake.
The Big what?
Quill Lakes in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. There's a flooding. Arable land is being flooded out. The farmers are being displaced there. We have a small operation there similar to here.
But not many.
Yeah, this.
You got 1,000 lakes on the Tibetan Plateau. I don't know how they're doing. They're used for mineral extraction. China.
1,000 lakes. Would you take a look at least 900 of them?
A few years ago, the Prince of Great Salt Lake hosted the International Saline Lake Research Bunch. And there were a number of papers from China on terminal lakes on the Tibetan Plateau.
Good question. Comment.
Andre, on any of the lakes, was there anything, when you look at correlation of hydrology, that the lakes, you know, some of these are pretty large in the Great Salt Lake. I know at least some of the studies that I've heard of and seen talk about 5 to 8% of our hydrology actually comes from the Great Salt Lake. Are there any similar correlations to the hydrology that those lakes contributed to the downwind regions?
So these are all terminal lakes.
Not riverine flow, but evaporation contributing to the atmosphere. I mean, Utah spends money on cloud seeding. The Great Salt Lake is a natural cloud seeder. Is there data of other lakes that show that water that's evaporated off that contributes to the, you know, here it's the Wasatch Front that receives a boost in hydrology at that level? Is there any studies on that?
Not really a question we asked.
Yeah, that wasn't something we focused on.
Didn't come
on.
Up in the review.
Again, this was a pure literature review, so.
Well, that's what I'm asking, if there's any.
Yeah, rather than hydrology, it's the consequences of drying.
Okay.
Other questions, comments, yes?
So Andrea, great presentation, first of all. But when you look through all of those lakes, is there, in all of, there's a significant restoration cost for every single one of those. And some of those countries, it seems like it would be easy to just kind of walk away and, you know, the economics are what they are and you just kind of change the fishing and those kinds of things. Was there a common thread of what was driving the expenditure of that money? And you know, is it the social consequences, the environmental, is there a common thread, maybe particularly in California, number one? And second of all, and again, maybe California, where did that money come from? And who's paying all those restoration costs, or how do they fund that?
I'm trying to remember, is it Owen the lake now in California, where it's 2 months out of every Los Angeles ratepayers' bill goes to mitigation efforts. So in that case, it's the ratepayers that are funding the restoration. So there's different mechanisms that can be used in other countries. You know, that that's not the case. You've seen some agreements between countries where they've been funding it, or they've been able to get other countries, like Japan has invested some money. And so there's been other investments in some of these countries that can't afford to do the restoration. And in some cases, the restoration costs are so high that it's likely that they're not going to do as much as they could. So.
And the reason I asked the first part of that question is what's the driver for this? Because I think, you know, we say, you know, birds are gonna die, maybe a little cynical, but I think people don't care as much about other things. In California, was it the social impact?
I would say the greatest cost is that the social impacts from the PM10.
The dust.
Yeah, because you're going to have very high health impacts that are affecting a lot of people, and so I think that's probably the biggest driver.
When Mono Lake was lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. Andre, when you talk about the PM10, the impacts. When you talk about the Salton Sea, they talked about reduction in property value. Is that associated indirectly to the PM10, the air quality, or the agricultural industry?
That was also odor as well.
Okay.
But the dust storms are a major part of that.
you kind of just, the quick cursory, one of the messages is that huge amounts of money are going into lakes that may or may not. Is there some kind of tipping point, basically, at which you cannot sustain enough of the system or whatever? And you know, California, probably lawsuits and everything else. They have to do some mitigation for Owens Valley or Salton Sea or whatever. But when you flashed up those sites, was there any one of them and it's like, yeah, we included it, but it's, you know, ecologically, the system's just too far gone to really try to restore?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Aral Sea, where I believe it's the South Aral Sea that's completely gone, where that's likely not going to come back. So yes, there is, you know, potential that some of these lakes are not going to be you know, ever be what they once were. I think probably a lot of them are never going to be what they once were, but it's more so at the point of trying to mitigate things so they don't get any worse.
One more question.
I guess just on that note, I was intrigued by that on the Aral Sea. I remember when the group from was here for Great Salt Lake, the biannual
issues
for her. Thank you. They were talking about how our Great Salt Lake, the bifurcation through the railroad and the causeways, gives the opportunity, if you are going to have times either anthropogenically or natural loss of water, you can choose where to put that water in terms of managing it.
I think there was some people from Salton Sea, wasn't it?
Was it Salton? Okay. But even the example you gave there is one where, well, do we let this other one dry up and then look like they were restoring the fishery in the other one, in the north?
Mm-hmm.
So. It's good stuff for the amount of budget and time you had.
As I mentioned before, I was delighted with how much substantive information, numbers in particular, that there was. It ended up being a 64-page report. I think if you think back at the reports we published a number of years ago, the economic report and the health report on the lake, they were both fairly substantive in terms of information. And I think you have to recognize that there are a few avid folks who will read this line by line, but most people are going to need some help in that regard. And so in the past, we created a glossy summary for both of those reports. I'd like to proceed to do that with this one as well. It'll be a little more difficult because there's so much substantive information. I mean, the summary table is 4 pages near the beginning of the report, and it's a really useful tool because it summarizes all these numbers by lake, of course, without the narrative. But we need some kind of an executive summary, much like the ones we did before. And without objection, I'll pursue that kind of a summary.
I'll second that. That's one thing I was thinking was needed, is to condense it down into that kind of simple, bite size. Thank you.
So it's more digestible for more people.
I think with the focus, I really liked how you took, here's the characterization of that lake. Here's how that translates potentially to the Great Salt Lake, economically, environmentally, and socially, and monetizing that.
So we do have a motion to pursue that approach, and we have a second. Any discussion, suggestions? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? Unanimous. Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate that.
Sorry, Don, do we need more funding for that? Is that additional scope that needs to be?
Well, let me come back and talk about the law, and there was some money left over from the report, from the reports. May be able to redirect this project. Okay, thank you. So a number of years ago, we were very much involved in promoting creation of water resource management, an integrated water resource management model, and that model has now made its way to the hands of the Division of Water Resources. It's been a while since it's had an update, and so we've invited them to make a presentation, give us an update, and tell us what the next steps might be. And Krishna Khatri of the Division of Water Resources will make that presentation.
Thank you, Don, for this opportunity. Good morning, everyone. So today I'm here just to update you what is the current status of the Integrated Water Resources Management model that was built maybe 2-3 years earlier on. So main objective is to update you how the model looks like and where and how this model can be applied. So that's the main focus. If you have any question on that, it will be great. So how this model looks like, where and how we can use this model. So this is based on the evaluation process where me and Craig were involved in last years. So we did the model evaluation starting from August 2017 to almost this year's January. So we did in the three phases. First phase, we got the models and report from CS2M Hill. We reviewed the model, and then we sent the comments and everything to Fire and Forestry and also CS2M Hill. Then we moved to the next level. We got the feedback from the consultant. There was a little bit addition on the snow component and the bidirectional flow. That was really good. But we really struggled on calibration of these models, and we got several errors, and then we were struggling to reproduce what was reported. So we informed to the fire and forestry, and then we asked if this model can be shared to the other agency or technical committee. We waited for a while. We were also working in the office, but we didn't get anything. Then finally, we talked with Jeff, and we tried to contact with the core modeling people if they can help, how they build models, if there is a gap in communication and reporting. And then we did a series of Skype communication with the Jacob's team. So finally, we got the updated model in October 2018 and the extended version in December 17, 2018. So whatever results or features I'm presenting here based on these models and the results. So we are very thankful to the Jeff. I think he ran his machinery without any funding, any resources. People sort of like Armin, Paula, Kenzie, they were so useful. 2 weeks I was running the models, generating all the errors and posting them, and then they were sending back, hey, this is the solution, and then we agreed on some of those, you know, issues. Now I think it's in an updated version. So in this presentation, I will be dividing the three components. Firstly will be just to introduce you what is the model features and assumptions, just to refresh you, maybe 2 years or 2 years you may have seen this presentation. Then I'll show you the simulation results based on some of the scenarios. Then finally, I'll show you how these model performances are and where can we do or what are the additional things that we need to do. So whatever I'm presenting is, since 2017 August when I joined the Division of Water Resources. So if you have any questions about a technical issue of the Great Salt Lake, my supervisor and the manager, Craig Miller, is here. So you raise his hand and then jump on that. Similarly, if you have any questions about planning, policies, or resources that Division of Water Resources is putting over there, so Candice is there. She's the assistant director and the head of the planning branch. So any questions, I think she will be happy to answer.
So Craig gets the first one, so I get the second one.
And Jeff is there, he's laughing. So he knows everything about the model. I think he will jump and help me to correct if I mislead anything. So going to the model feature, if we see, click on the model, we can see those in this figure. You know, you can see wetland, lake, basin, climate, those stuff. So this model was built in the Goldstein platform. I think you all know that. But the main feature of this model is, special of this model compared to any other USGS model is, it allows to simulate all the effects of the watershed to the lake. Not only lake, including, that's, I think we all know that. So in addition to that, it has three modules. That's the first one is the river basin module, which is exactly what I said. And the other, if we want to simulate only the lake and the wetland effect to the lake, there is a second module, they call the dynamic module, and there is also only the lake, only that's a lake model. So three modules are inside this model, so there is an option to run any of those modules. So if you go in the river basin model, we can see, except the wash desert, all those upper watershed and the lakes are connected. So those whole area were divided in 305 and within the 12 kilometer grids. So within that, rainfall and runoff was analyzed. So that means soils, that's all the vegetation, everything was considered in that. And then those rainfall and runoff were aggregated to the 38 sub areas to analyze how the water demand supplies are moving around those boxes. So if we see in this whole picture, we can see the Great Salt Lake here, and all those boxes are connected. Principally, if something goes wrong in these boxes, we'll be able to analyze. I think that was the ideal situation of this model. Similarly, if you go in the lake module, it's exactly similar to the USGS. So if we want to see the north, south, and those portion only, so that is the option to run on that. And there is also the dynamic module as I mentioned. It allows to simulate the different vegetation within the wetland and then see how that affects to the lake. So all those assumptions, whatever are in the lake or wetland models are based on the USGS, all those modeling equations. So there is nothing done, just it was plugged inside the gold sim. So whatever, you know, results and everything we can find in the USGS, I think this is really stable, it's a good one. So if we want to see the model, how it works, we can see that box edge. This is a river basin, wetland, lake, and there are so many options. So inside these boxes, there are more than 11,000 small elements. So it's a really, really messy kind, but from the outside, it's really good. It's easy to plot, you know, this spot where we are going. For example, if I want to go to the lake module, then it allows to set the what are the initial conditions in the different hydraulic features in the lake, and there is a causeway features we can set on those. Then after running the model, if you want to see the results, for example, the lake, you know, south or north, the salinity, water balance. So this is the kind of illustrations to how this model starts. So this is general introduction. Then we may be interested in how this model simulates the lake level or salinity, you know, using the different scenarios. So just I ran the hypothetical scenarios, wanted to see how the lake level and salinity will change 2017 to 2040. So I didn't have the data for how the land use, water demand, or climate, everything changed in the future. For simplification, for the illustration purpose, you know, we assume, okay, 1989 to 2012, temperature, precipitation, water usage is similar, you know, same. But the lake level is starting from 2017, 1st of January. Then I ran those five scenarios. Okay, they, you know, based, using the first scenario, what if there is only changes in the temperature by 0.5 degrees centigrade, that means around 1 degree Fahrenheit. What if there is only 1% of precipitation decreases? Similarly, combination of two and population growth. So just for the illustration purpose, like this is the base scenario. It means if we have the input similar to 1989 to 2012 and just project for the future, so the lake levels will go in the different time period from 2017 to 2040. So if you go to the 0.5 degree temperature increase, the lake level is going down. Similarly, the precipitation and the combination of those and the population run. So basically the message here is, well, lake level is naturally, you know, is going down. So they, even if we think of using the same pattern of using the, you know, water diversion or water usage, then if we see the temperature and precipitation, then those values are significant. So lake level is really sensitive to the changes in the temperature and precipitation. And definitely the mean levels is going down. That's the one rough information that we can pull out from these scenarios. So if we plot last 60 years, like 1950 to 2012 data, then the average seems like 4198. But now the questions we have is, you know, what is the tipping point? What should be the, you know, just the working, that's the main, you know, the lake level that we need to have. So I think by running those scenarios, it will help us to identify that range of the, you know, that's optimum range of the optimum level of the lake that we want to maintain. So if we see the USGS, like 2017 was really wet year, then it's not that the lake peak is not going that much up. So the main message is the lake level is sensitive to the change in the temperature, precipitations, and I think, you know, the average level we are used to say 4,200 may not be the valid in the current situation. So similarly, this is the salinity, just forcing all those hydrological the scenarios, the salinity will be changing like this. Well, this is just for the illustration how these models can be used for the scenario. Then do you trust this model? So what is the performances of this model? That would be the question. Then based on these performances of the model, what can be the next step that we need to do to make this model usable? So in this case, if we see the lake and dynamic model, so this one is the observed value. And if we see the lake only, this is the red line, and the dynamic one is 0.97. So regression is really good level. I think it makes sense because it was, same algorithm, everything that was used by USGS since 1970 has been just used here. So there is no doubt that we need to go further, but we were able to get these results in the model. That's a good one. However, similarly, this is the salinity one. The model is producing the good results, but this hydraulics is getting changed. Like there is old bridge and new bridge. So USGS is collecting the data, how the type of interaction between north and south salinity. So we need to update this model using this new bridge. That's how the flow takes place in the lake, in the presence of this new bridge. So it's the one component that we need to update in this model. Similarly, I think the main objective or motivation of using the GoldSim model, GoldSim platform, was to simulate the different type of scenarios. But in this model, we can see there are so many activities going even within the lake, but that has not been captured well inside the model. So we need to have those scenarios updated inside the model. So if we want to see, if some ponds or, perhaps differently how that will affect to the lake, so it's not included. So there is in the simulation, but we cannot run the scenarios. It needs additional work. And also in this model, the salinity is only the surface one. It doesn't analyze any deep brine layer issues. And also, it doesn't account for the water quality issue. So I don't know how the division of water quality will be using this model. Or if we want that component, then it needs additional work. So that is for the lake and the wetland. But if you see in the integrated one, so this is the observation. And this one is the models, red one is the models, how the lake level will change. Statistically, it's not bad, 0.88, but I think that if we see so many boxes, it looks so easy to see there. They are connecting inside the model, but we don't see, how those reservoirs are operating, the reservoir operation rules, how this, this snow melt process is taking place. And there is also the issue of the routing, how the water flows from one recess to the another point. So those are the components that it has to be verified in this module. So since lake model and wetland model works good, but main usability of this model will be if we could do something in the integrated model. So if you see in this water balance, that's about 61%, two-thirds of the water is from the upstream. And also the contribution of the different watersheds, you can see the Bear has the high 58% and other river basins. And also, we want to run the scenarios, to run the scenario, we need to know how the future temperature, precipitation, or the climatic parameters also the land use, populations, water use, diversions will change. So we need to have some ideas and those components inside the model. So in this model, it's not included. So there is room to build on, to add on, but now in the current version, we cannot find that. So we need to update the climate, populations, and also that we need to add something to run the scenarios. So while in summary, lake model and dynamic model, it works very good. But all those, whatever algorithms are used inside the models are based on the USGS one. Even the USGS uses the regression equation that was developed in 1970s. Now all those climatic information we can pull in the grid. So we need to update for the climate parameters. We need to update for the bidirectional flow when there is a new breeze. Also, if we want to analyze further like a deep brine layer, then and scenario analysis, that those component has to be added in the model. So if you go to the river basin model, I think in these models we need more work. I think the first component is really good, but this in this case, like, it's very complex, like how to include this reservoir operation, snowpack, snowmelt analysis, and also to analyze sub-area water balance analysis, and those are the major tasks that we need to incorporate in the model. So those are the just the kind of major list we discussed with the Jacobs, with a long list of specific tasks, what we want to do. So this is the summarized form. You know, we can provide if anyone of the team interested in. So to move forward, I think there is something going on, how this model can be, you know, supported and how we can, you know, operationalize. I saw this diagram, but I don't know the details. Maybe Laura and Jeff can help to explain if you have any questions. So that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Do you want to go back to that diagram? Okay. And I think Jeff, chime in if I'm missing something, but I think one of the next steps we were thinking about is reorganizing this committee that we had developed when we started the IWRM and get them on the same page with where the current model is, and then moving forward with kind of the phase two rollout, public dissemination of the information in the model. But we want to reconvene the technical team for the IWRM in short order. Is that what you're thinking, Jeff?
Yeah, we had a proposed rollout plan, and a key component, which is briefly one of the key success factors for models like this, is that the community takes ownership of it and it's used. A lot of times we develop these models for specific clients and they're used to answer a question and then they're shelved. Other people, districts, agencies develop their own competing models and it becomes even more complicated. But where the community is able to take a model like this and then as a community develop the model together, that's where this is, becomes a very powerful tool. And so this organizational infrastructure structure is one of the key components that we delivered. And the basis is that there's a number of state agencies, you see in the orange, that are implementing it to make decisions, working with their own stakeholders. But there's one modeling agency, who's really holding the model and running or keeping it maintained. And then there's a technical committee that's guiding the development of that model. So that we always maintain a central model. People might take it and spin off and do other things, but everybody can come back to the same agreed to platform.
And I think that's really important from water resources perspective, is to have a technical committee that helps tell us what you guys want us to do with them. What is the priority in, you know, those recommended improvements to the model? What's the priority? What's the best thing that for us to do? We don't want to make that decision, to be honest. We want the technical committee and you all to inform us what to do.
One additional thing.
Oh, Dan, sorry. Oh, go ahead, Craig, nonetheless.
One additional thing that was left off of the changes that should be made is the period of record that's used for future casting is 1987 to 2012. And so if you look at that period, it gave a median elevation of the lake of 4192, but other models indicate that that median elevation, if you were to include a longer period of record for your flows and weather, it'd be closer to maybe 4 feet higher, 3 to 4. So, and what happens when the lake's lower is any future depletions will have a magnified effect. And so we, in order to get a more realistic view, we're going to have to include a longer period. And that isn't particularly easy with how it's set up right now.
Tom, you had a question, and Dan?
I think, Laura, if we go back to the organizational chart, I think going back to Andre's presentation, I think at least one item that stuck out that isn't captured in this would be how much of a factor the social public health impacts and air quality. And if one of the things I'm taking away from that message is the multi-billion dollar costs that communities are having to spend on trying to either restore a lake or mitigate the health impacts, you know, air quality and the public health of, you know, 90% of the people that live in Utah live right proximate to the lake. Whatever decisions made for water rights, water resources, or natural environment, if we're not plugging that in, I'm just looking at one of the takeaways from your presentation is the public health impacts and air quality related items. So it seems that ought to be somewhere fundamentally on that chart, because decisions made with this group is going to impact that area, and that has a financial impact, not just public health, but then economically. So if we distribute an Owens Valley economic impact to the state of Utah, our entire state, our GDP is maybe 10% of LA, and yet the cost would be 10 times as large. It could bury us, so.
You from Dan?
Yes, I was glad to see that there was a number five that said Bear River plan. Now, if you would have added that missing 220,000 acre feet of water and put that in there, I don't think you'd come back up as high. So every time you have a low point and you go up high, it never goes up as high as it was before. So you're on a downward slope. So just guessing, how much difference would that make?
I think that, so all the diversion that is, you know, that will be in the future has not been incorporated in the model. So they, you may have seen the box, like a Bear River project, but there is no analysis within this model. So maybe Craig can answer your question based on his experience, but you know, knowing what the model does, because I'm not in a position to answer your question.
Correct.
Leila.
Well, if you want to know average amounts that the lake will go down, it's probably 8/10 of a foot per 100,000 acre feet at this point. So if, of depletion. So if you just take water and put it to another part of the lake and it returns, then that's not a depletion. So looking at things like the Bear River project, you have to determine how much is actually lost to evaporation. And that's generally what we found, is it's about 8/10 of a foot per 100,000 acre feet of loss.
You know, there's, be nice to find a way to utilize this model in conjunction with, and maybe the question is this possible at this point in time with the current model, in conjunction with the recommended state water strategy that's gone out and the concepts that are placed in it on conservation, what will those do for lake levels? Or do they just simply maintain it not dropping any further? And the other one would be to add into that the Great Salt Lake Management Plan, which does talk about concerns at different lake levels. You know, that would be the kind of document or presentation that we can make to a legislative committee that would be informational for them to look at. And so the question is, can we make this model in its current faulted state, if anything, if that's the wording you want, in its current state, can we make that model work to give us an information we can present forward? Or is it, are we saying we need to do a whole bunch of improvements before we do that kind of a presentation? Because we spent a lot of money on this model, and it'd be really nice to be able to go back to a legislative committee and say, here's what we know from the model, here's how it integrates with the state water strategy, and here's how it falls out based on this, on the Great Salt Lake Management Plan as to what impacts those create to the beneficial uses of the lake. Does that make sense?
And
what would it take to do that?
And that can be monetized, at least, you know.
Sure, sure. But what would it take to do that? Is that something we can do with this existing model?
I have a question for Craig. We're right to the top of the chain here, Craig. You can answer it, we'll go to the
chain. There's a number of things that it doesn't do right now, which we would certainly like it to do. And as far as costs go, I can't answer that question right now.
Well, but if we could, using the strategy, using the costs we know, using the management plan with its warning levels that were in that, because they had levels, right? Mm-hmm. So we talk about levels in the management plan. And if we got the right people in the room, you could come up with a presentation, in my opinion, that we could give back to governance to say, why do you need to worry? Because right now, we've done a model, and we've got House Concurrent Resolution 10 is passed towards the governor, which says, let's worry about lake level, but we don't show anything to say, here's where we're headed. In other words, if you go back to your graph on the lake, where it goes back to 4190, you know, and you have the table which goes down to the low of 4180, well, 4180 is a 84. That's a, you know, you have that graph. You know. You know, have the back one.
One more. It was way back.
One more.
I think it's on the average.
Well, no, you had one more graph.
One more back.
Yeah.
It's a graph in
your simulation. Hypothetical.
Oh, hypothetical. Okay.
There. So if you look at this table,
yeah.
I mean, we're talking a mean of, with these increases of 4190.82, well, that's a significant number. And then if you talk about, can it be improved with water conservation? You know, that's an important point to know, because then they can look at conservation as a target and say, how far can conservation get us, voluntarily or otherwise? You know, but, you know, and what happens if the temperatures, instead of 0.5, it's 3. You know, what does that do? And so those worst case scenarios would allow us to go back and say, how do we use all this information? We've got these three documents that seriously talk about Great Salt Lake and concerns, but not one of them has presented individually the connectivity of all these issues. And so getting those connected, I think, is critical for us to be able to do our job as a council and report back to the legislature saying, you know, here's how this integrates and how the concerns are.
This wasn't my idea, but I've heard it mentioned, the Envision Utah is one of the entities that kind of takes these broader topics that transcend social, political, economic, environmental, and decision-making process. Leland, what you're talking about, you know, whether it's Envision Utah or some other entity that's broader than our Great Salt Lake Advisory or Great Salt Lake stakeholders, people aren't understanding how the lake is connected to them in a lot bigger ways.
Yeah.
And those decisions are going to be made either in the darkness or our goal, I think, around the table here, the broader table, right, is that those who have a stake in that, who basically some 80-90% of people live in Utah, maybe everybody lives in Utah, has a stake in that.
But I'm not worried about trying to find a way to relate this to the 2, 3, 4 million people in the state of Utah. I want to relate it to the 104 people in the legislature so they know they have to act. or they need to have an indication that something is really in their ballpark to make a change. And if we can't integrate these items, well, we're not doing a very good job. So what would it take to do that?
Let's go Ann and then Lynn. Yeah. Ann first, and then we'll come to you, Lynn.
I totally agree with what Leon is saying. I think it's a really important, and this is a really important graph. And one thing I really encourage the water resources not to use is a mean. A mean in a social setting, what we have year to year, is meaningless because we're basically at 4190-ish, 92-ish now, and we're having dust problems. So if you use a mean, it's not helpful. It's the min and the max, and the length of the time that any one of them is gonna be at that level is far more meaningful than a mean.
I mean, 4184 is, that cuts off almost every mineral extraction company.
Yes.
And possibly rancher.
And brine shrimp.
It doesn't cut it off, Leland. It forces a change in how we
shut down
brine. Right. But it makes it much more difficult, right? So that kind of a number is pretty important.
Lynn, your comment or question?
Thank you. It's very difficult to hear. So perhaps someone has already mentioned this. I appreciate all of the cumulative insight that we're talking about as it relates to the desiccation report and also the integrated water resource management model. I'm just wondering if, since we seem to be continuing on the path of putting together data, is it not time for perhaps taking the next step, using the, as Leland suggested, using the reference of the state water strategy and the Great Salt Lake Level Matrix to convene a process to collectively recognize what range of lake elevation is something we want to shoot for. You know, we keep talking about the would-be could-bes, but we haven't really recognized among lake users and people who value the system what it is, where it is we need to target a, you know, HE's conservation pool, because that is electric, but in terms of a recognition of a zone elevation, bottom and high, what's going to work to sustain ecosystem services that we can all agree upon?
Well, I think, again, we do have some funding. If we needed to put someone on this to pull these all together, I mean, I know that staff doesn't have all the time in the world, but this is, I mean, we have a charter, it's to do this, to let people know what this means. So, and we have the documents in place. We have a strategy that the state has said, we're gonna start looking at this, that was done through Envision Utah, and they were strongly involved in that. Now what we need to do is take that, plus the management plan, because it has some great information in the management plan. And we have the people, basically, in this room who were involved in all of those. And so,
go ahead, Jeff.
The architecture of this model allows you to do exactly what you're talking about. And I mean, every question has its own unique spin to it, and so the model needs to be adapted to address the specific question you're doing. But the platform is there. That was what it was designed to do, is exactly what you talked about, and is to be flexible. And I think the key way that this can be used is exactly what Krishna's already started doing, is looking at scenarios, is to evaluate how sensitive is the model to any change, whether it's population or water use or conservation or reuse or ag or climate, or you can go through hundreds of variables to identify, you know, what is most important in driving the lake level, and then, you know, we can look at 72 or however many options and say, well, can we reduce that from 72 to what are the top 10 or top 5 means of of addressing the lake level. And at that point, you need to get into, I think where Krishna's driving was mentioning is, then typically you go from a scenario planning model into the specific, you know, you're getting into operational models and, you know, very detailed models to really nail things down. But this model was designed to, at a planning level, be able to say, you know, what moves the needle? And so I think we can move forward doing something like that. But I mean, it does take, and that's why we have this infrastructure organizational component to it, is we need, you know, for this to work, you need to have people who are familiar with the model, who are getting input, who can sort through that input and make those modifications to it.
What would we need to do to move forward on that, David? Put together a subcommittee to...
Well, I think we can
force it out. We have money that's unallocated through the end of this year.
I think that we need forestry fire involved, obviously, and water quality probably wants to be in there. Although I'm not talking the water quality component right now. They're integrated in that. And then, I think that of course, you guys in natural resources, the water folks, need to have that because you're working on the model. But I don't know if any one of these people. You want to throw your hand up there, so go ahead.
Because I love the idea. I think one of the things that we would need is there's a lot of elements of the water strategy, although very excellent, are a little vague. And so defining those scenarios when it says conservation or when it says, you know, we should support agriculture, or, you know, these kind of vague concepts, what does that actually mean as what we're inputting into the model? So I think that would have to be included in that group.
I don't think you're going to get any authority figure to tell you what those mean. But I think we can make interpretations with a group of decent people who know what's going on those documents and in the lake, on the lake. And so, you know, when they did the strategy on conservation, they said, when they did it on the online survey, they gave you pictures even to say, here's the different kinds of conditions that you may have to have. And it was like, you know, significant reduction in green space. And so if we can make that reduction, what does it mean? You know, and so you could utilize those documents to say, here's how we're interpreting it. Mm-hmm. And a small group could put that together. Yeah. You know, I don't know, Lauren, what do you think? I mean, on the management plan, the information's already there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Lauren did the management plan. Mm-hmm. Those are better than anybody. You know, the only question is does the divisions have time to do this, or do we need to bring a consultant in to consolidate it to get it done quickly?
Like a Steve Clyde.
What?
Like a Steve Clyde.
Well, I think you'd want them to say, you know, which one of these targets, I mean, in theory, maybe not, I don't know. Until the end of the night, I'll know. We have, it looks like 400,000 now, to look at how to implement some of these conservation issues. And it wouldn't be bad to go back to the committee and say, you know, here's the concepts that we're going to look at and why, and here's what happens if you do some of those, to the best of our guess today. And then it gives us the ability of saying, getting their buy-in on which ones we are going to actually study, you know, and not try and study the ones that are have no potential to ever be happening.
Well, last September, when we talked about allocation of the funding we received for the current year, that was one of the items we agreed to allocate a material amount of money to address the implementation of these strategies. So,
and it looks like
I would say we need I'd ask you, Leland, who do you need on the subcommittee you're going to chair?
I think obviously water resource folks need to be there, whoever you have there. Obviously, forestry fire, obviously. Obviously it'd be nice to have one of the co-chairs of the water strategy. Oh, that would be Tim Hawks. It would be nice to have him in the room too. And that certainly gives us a connection to the committee, you know. But, and then anyone else who feels like, Ant knows a lot. So any of these people who are involved would be there. I think we'd want to have, Jacob's folks and decide whether or not we can afford to have them put some of this together. If the division say, we just don't have enough time in the day to make this happen quickly, let's get someone in to do it.
Well, they do have enough time to help us prepare an RFP.
Right.
Or an RFQ.
So, you know, I don't think it'd take a ton of us, but I think some of us would be involved.
Is that a motion, Leland?
I make that motion.
Is there a second? How about discussion? Don't want to railroad anybody here, so debate discussion first of all, then go ahead.
I just have a question. How many of the scenarios or situations do you think that this group would care to tackle right now?
Well, I think that's part of the discussion, is to say how much can we accomplish, you know, and which ones can we say have substance that we can look at?
We prioritize 18.
Right.
And some of those are duplicative, and some maybe don't take into account others that are, we ought to look at.
An observation, perhaps. You mentioned every 100,000 acre feet is about 0.8 of a foot.
And that's the mean, and that's
where I'm going. This is a set of, in some ways, what we're talking about here is doing sensitivity analysis of the models. So if we said every community that's on a watershed that drains the Great Salt Lake did maximum conservation. What is that? Quantitate that first and say, is there an opportunity to save 100,000 acre feet a year with maximum conservation efforts? That's going to do is, instead of having a single line on this, and you've got these four cases right here versus I assume the base case was nothing changes. It's just, right? What you're going to end up is, theoretically, you're going to have two different curves out there. One is maximum conservation, one is base case. And you're going to end up with a different scenario here. That would help you bound those endpoints. I'm just suggesting that. So, in terms of the number of simulations that you want to run, you need to try and say, things get a lot worse, things get a lot better in terms of return water to the lake. Look at what that envelope is and say, how much difference is there? Are we talking about 2 feet or 4 feet or 5 feet in terms of the delta?
Let me pull this back to the council members, because we have a motion and a second. Any debate among council members or discussion about that?
I'd like to just
go ahead.
Talk quickly about something Leland mentioned. It's not really a water quality issue. I would say if the lake ever is 4185, we have a salinity issue. I don't know what, you know, the brine shrimp upper bound of salinity is, but that feels like it's pushing it.
Yeah, you'll saturate the whole lake at that level.
And that's gonna change how we operate. I mean, Cargill already had problems several years ago when the lake was too salty.
18% interferes with reproductivity, so.
So, you know, the North Arm was at 16 before the bridge was constructed. And we were struggling.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion related to that motion and second?
Just for...
I got to hold this one up. Advise the council members. Okay, really quickly.
Okay, so with respect to running the scenarios and getting the extreme, you know, the rains, it's doable. We have, you know, personally, I think I can bring that number, a dependable number technically. Only what we are, you know, looking for here is we need to validate this model. So we need additional resources. At least we need to be confident on, you know, this model is doing a good job. Then running the scenarios, I think we can do that.
I'll call for a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Any abstentions?
Anybody want to be part of the initial committee? I'm looking over at Utah because you deal with water.
Okay, so we've got a representative group from the council, and we'll get some ex officio members who are not council members. Really quickly, let's move to agenda item number 11. I wanted to remind you that last fall we approved the letter from the SIM conference round to the governor. That letter was delivered to the governor. The essence of the letter was that Utah should implement an overall policy that supports effective allocation and administration of water flow to the Great Salt Lake, use of water within its watershed to maintain or increase lake levels while balancing economic, social, and environmental needs. At our January meeting, we came up in November in our January meeting, we approved a second step, and that was to go forward with a House concurrent resolution. We had some conversation here. You authorized me to make some modifications, and I did to accommodate the issues raised by Todd Adams. I want to send out, as Leland already mentioned, I'm sending out a version of the legislation, House Concurrent Resolution 10, that shows the basic changes that were made in the legislature. As Leland mentioned, this has been approved by both the House and Senate. If you turn to the back page, on the House side, the key change was in the paragraph talking about the ecosystems could face a similar fate due to, he said, historic and current water management practices. The word current was taken out. Thought the emphasis should be on historic, and frankly, that was a request made by the governor's office. And then down below, the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council was removed because our status isn't the same as the Department of Environmental Quality and Department of Natural Resources. And they added a report from those two departments no later than November 30, 2020 in the Senate. The term allocation became quite a hot topic, particularly among agricultural interests, and so that was removed, and the line, including the need to sustain working agricultural land, was added. And with that, there was not a vote cast negative in either the House or the Senate for this bill. And as Leland mentioned, it's really an incorporation of the letter that Jeff Richards and Tom Ward got us on the path with, and basically establishing a state policy that we need to address the climate and Great Salt Lake water levels. So appreciate those who helped get this enacted. And there were a number of other Great Salt Lake related bills that were considered in legislation. We'll go through them in detail at our May meeting. None of them were Great Salt Lake Advisory Council bills. We didn't vote to sustain or support them all. Several of them were consistent with our water strategy prioritization, such as water banking, which set up an interim study, which was approved. A watershed council. Legislation was never formally introduced. It got hung up on membership issues. Suffice it to say, there was significant support for significant Great Salt Lake representation in that process, and I expect that to come back. The in-stream flow issue for trout, which was sunsetting, was extended. Leland mentioned he secured $400,000 of funding for Great Salt Lake Research. There was a bill to step back on the landfill Class 5 authorization admitted to the House. It was amended with an effective date at the end of 2020, but it appears to be dying in the Senate. And then there was a secondary water metering requirement bill that went through five different versions in the Senate and finally survived, got to the House just a couple days ago, and it may be on life support. So we'll see whether that emerges. So any other very brief reports on Great Salt Lake legislation? Hearing none, we'll move on. We like to have a public comment period during our meetings. Can I get some indication as to whether there's anyone here who wants to make a public comment in addition to what's already been said? And we'll open, seeing none, we'll open and close the public comment period. Our next meeting is May 8th, where we'll have a more detailed discussion about the legislative issues. And I'd entertain any other suggestions or recommendations for that meeting.
This is a side issue, but can we get that posted on the website?
Both presentations, can we get them on the website? Thank you, Jay. Appreciate that. Good request. Any other comments from advisory council members? I apologize for running late. I appreciate your being here. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Any abstentions? Unanimous. Thank you for being